Howdy, folks. Rob Wolf here. This is the Paleo Solution Podcast. And today we have a very special guest, very excited. As all of you know, I am not much of an endurance athlete myself. I have no background in this area. And so I figured that we would get one of the possibly most written about, best respected people who not only has participated in endurance and ultra endurance athletics, but has brought this to the masses. And this is Joe DeSena, founder of the Spartan Race and author of the forthcoming book, Spartan Up, which is due out, I believe, Joe, May 13th?
May 13th, lucky awesome. 13th.
Very yeah. Cool, right on. Well, how are you doing?
I'm a little tired.
Tell folks why you're a little tired.
Yeah, so CAF just became one of our key charities for Spartan Race. That's the Challenge Athletes Foundation. And when you go out to, we went out to their offices out in California, it just blows you away how they all came about. And, you know, somebody basically needed a prosthetic and they raised the money. And then they've gone on to do that hundreds and hundreds of times. Anyway, they invited us, us being my son and I, my eight-year-old, to an event in Boston on Friday night. And the marathon was Monday yesterday. And we went to the event and they had a bunch of the victims from the last year's Boston Marathon that were wearing prosthetics. And my son and I got into this whole discussion, which led to a four-mile run, him and I, nice and really slow, Friday night, which led to, hey, Dad, I want to do the marathon on Monday. and so we went out, and I didn't know if they were going to throw us off the course or what, because I had a number, but obviously he didn't have a number. And everybody was awesome. We had his name on a shirt, and for 5.5 hours, people had us elevated off the ground because they just kept screaming, go Jack, touching him on the head. And I think it was just inspirational for the runners, for everybody to have this little guy out there. And we got to mile 24 where we found my wife, his mom, and I didn't know if we can go across the finish line because I would assume they were going to stop us. And he wanted to go, and then my wife, we have other children, and she was like, why don't you just pack it in here? And so ultimately we decided, let's pack it in there. And I thought it was probably better for Jack because he was feeling it at mile 24. What I didn't know is that my wife had parked 2.5 miles from that location, so we ended up walking anyway, and we should have probably just walked to the finish line.
So you got in the 26.2 no matter how you slice it.
I ended up at about 33 yesterday because I had to walk to the car, load them in, get my bags, carry everything back, only to find out I had a meeting at the finish line to then go to the finish. It was just a very long post-marathon hike.
Wow. I would have been fatigued with the walk to the car. Like, that would have probably left me with rhabdo and cramping and stuff. So,
well, it's funny. You said you're a rapid-fire guy, a fast-twitch guy. And my children are all fast-twitch, so I didn't know how it was going to go.
Right.
And I think I had to monitor really closely because I just didn't want to have a blow-up situation. I didn't want to get pulled away by social services. but I kept an eye on him, knowing that he's really just like a 100-yard kind of guy. And he crushed it because nice. We went nice and easy. And every quarter mile, I made him eat something and drink something, poured water on his head. Like, we just monitored the situation well enough that if you go easy, you can get through anything.
That's been my experience. You know, I kind of joke about that, and usually I use my twitchiness as an excuse to just be lazy and not do stuff like that. But when I've been thrown into situations like that, I just really make sure that I stay under my red line, and I can usually motor through without too much problem. I'm usually good and sore later because clearly I'm not kind of work hardened for that specific stuff, but usually able to motor through. So what does your son usually do? Like, does he do much running day to day? Is he doing track at school? Like, how did you guys prep for that? Or he just,
so it's funny. This is a funny story. So I grew up in Queens, and my mom was very ahead of her time with the vegan diet and health food in Queens in the 70s. You know, it was a very Italian neighborhood. If you saw Goodfellas, I grew up right in the middle of that.
Okay.
And so for her, being into yoga, meditation, and like branch sandwiches, it was strange for everybody around us. So when my parents got divorced, my dad got us an account, my sister and I, at a local Chinese restaurant to be able to get away from my mom and eat quote-unquote regular food. And so, needless to say, I became very friendly with the Chinese restaurant owner, obviously a Chinese guy. And when we had our first child, the one that ran yesterday, I called him up and I said, hey, I need some help. I want to find a Mandarin-speaking Kung Fu teacher that doesn't speak English that would consider living in Vermont. And he found us somebody. So the kids now are almost on year two and a half years in to doing 7 days a week, 2 hours a day of Kung Fu.
Nice.
Which is really just like a bunch of kicks and discipline and stretching and a little bit of running and jumping. And then throughout Spartan's development and telling everybody about this Kung Fu experience, I've come across a lot of the Special Forces guys, and I came across a lot of the MMA guys. And both of them introduced me to, because I was not a wrestler myself, to American wrestling, and said, there's no sport like American wrestling. And Special Forces went on to explain that that's really who they want to recruit now. It's just American wrestlers. And the MMA guys told me, look, Brazilian jiu-jitsu is great, martial arts great, boxing great. But if you start at the core as an athlete with the American wrestling background, that person's almost unbeatable.
Right.
And so needless to say, there's a farm up the street from us in Vermont where there's a really good wrestler, a young guy, 23 years old. So he's now in the house training the kids too. So they do wrestling and Kung Fu. But it's all very fast burst type stuff like you're used to. And so I just didn't know how it was going to go. But he did it. He got done.
Oh, that's awesome. I mean, being mentally tough and just generally feeding the kids well. And then if they're active, then they've got that reserve. So that's phenomenal. And, you know, we talk a fair amount about mixed martial arts and stuff. I used to fight in Thai boxing, and I do some old dude Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And I had, I think 2 years of grade school wrestling, like a little Greco and a little bit of freestyle. And then the same thing in high school. And even that, and I mean, I was nothing to write home about, but even that little experience that I had with that has carried over so well, you know, more than 22 years later doing the Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And then just also kind of the work ethic that you get out of wrestling. I've noticed that when we've trained MMA athletes that have a wrestling background, my job as a coach is never to push these guys. Like my main job is making sure that these guys are not blown out on game day, because they will train themselves down to a fiery, burnt out husk by the time that it's actually ready to go. Like them actually showing up, you know, kind of super compensated and rested. Like they don't even know what to do with themselves, or like, really, I'm going to kind of taper for 5 days and not, you know, kill myself the last couple of days. It's like, no, man, you really need to take some time off to recover. And it's a hard thing to get through them. Like the work ethic is really phenomenal in these guys, which clearly the spec op scene and then the UFC and MMA, yeah, you know, they're just picking that up. Yeah. There's nothing else like that.
No, I think you're right. I mean, they're so used to coming in dehydrated and down on weight. Imagine if, like you're doing, imagine if they were fit when they got there.
Right, right. And if they actually get to eat consistently and have good sleep, then everything else is easy by comparison. Totally, totally.
Yeah.
Well, Joe, how did you, you know, you have a really incredible background ranging from finance and, you know, entrepreneurial endeavors. Tell people a little bit about your background and then how it transitioned into your own kind of exploration of endurance athletics, and then why you founded first the Death Race, which Death Race 2000 was one of my favorite movies ever, the old one with David Carradine and all that. So I actually, you know, when that popped up on the radar, I actually totally loved that because that was one of my all time favorite movies as a kid. But tell folks about that whole story. It's really amazing. I think it's stuff that people need to hear these days. I think that we don't, you know, there's lots of stories of success, but I think we need more and more of them. And also people understanding that the things that you learn in one vertical of life have transferable job skills in other verticals and how you've done that.
Yeah. And so that's your point with the wrestling. I think for my kids, and you clearly experienced it, that warrior instinct that comes out of wrestling, right? I think you can transfer to business. And I know so many people that are successful people in life now, and they were wrestlers. So for me, I wish I had that background. But I grew up in Queens, and it was a crazy upbringing, literally like that movie Goodfellas. My parents got divorced. My mom moved to Ithaca. My dad was doing really well the first, 10, 11 years of my life, and super smart guy, and got over-leveraged in the 80s with real estate, like a lot of people, and lost everything, which was really the greatest thing to happen to me, because it just changed my DNA and my pain thresholds and how much I'd ever want to be leveraged. And but it also, it got me to work. I went over to my neighbor's house and asked if I can clean his pool to make some money, and then not knowing he was the head of one of the organized crime families, and so he quickly made other people be my customers, but he got me lots of customers, which all happened to be in that same line of work. So over a 10 to 12 year period, I was lucky enough to build a pretty sizable swimming pool and construction business with very little bad debt, thanks to him. And it became really this my first experience in endurance. And I say that because in that business, everybody wants their job done now. They got little Johnny's birthday party this weekend, and the pool's got to be in and filled and clean or whatever it is. And if you have 750 customers all very demanding like that, it doesn't matter what the weather is outside, you're going to get the job done, or you'll never get the job again.
Or your kneecaps may be broken, one or the other.
Or you'll be under the swimming pool. So I did that for 10 or 12 years and worked literally like an animal, like your grandfather tells you about. And knock on wood, did really well, paid my way through college, and was lucky enough in college to meet. And one thing I've always done, and I don't know why I've done this, and I try to think, how am I going to teach my kids this? But I've always taken advice from older people, because I figure they already made their mistakes. And one of the guys I had met in at college was a very wealthy, very successful guy, and he stayed in touch with me after college while I was running this pool and construction business, and he begged me to go to Wall Street. And he gave me a stock tip one day and finally convinced me, because stock went up, and I thought, boy, that's a lot easier than doing all the physical work I'm doing. I'm going to Wall Street. And so sold my business to the only two guys that lasted with me for 10 or 12 years, who were both Polish nationals. They were from Poland. And literally, I went through hundreds and hundreds of employees, most of them lasting a day or 2 days. The workload was so enormous, no one really could keep up, except for these two Polish guys. So I sold them the business at a sweetheart deal, went to Wall Street, and was lucky enough, because now I had this entrepreneurial spirit and confidence, and quickly figured out how to start a business on Wall Street, and had another, knock on wood, great run from like 98, 99 to 2005. Sold it, and it was time to settle down. Met my wife, or at that time soon to be wife, and moved to Vermont to try to just slow down and get myself out of the craziness. At that time, I had already found adventure racing and endurance events for myself, because when I came out of the pool and construction, I was in great shape for all the physical work. Mm-hmm. When I got to Wall Street, it's very heavy on food and drinking, and it's just a terrible lifestyle. And quickly found myself out of shape and just not feeling great, especially knowing what feeling great is, coming from my mom back, as far back as, when I was 10 years old. And so wanted to get back into being healthy, and found myself stumbling upon somebody who was running stairs in the stairwell of my building in Manhattan. And he was on the cover of Men's Health. He was the epitome of health. And he got me into running the stairs. He got me into getting healthy again, and introduced some of these adventure races, which I'd never heard of. Really crazy long distance stuff, 8, 10, 12 days in the tundra, 30 below, zero, snow, just crazy stuff. And I just felt so cool doing it, and I was so broken at the same time, and just felt alive, and every single thing that you thought was a headache in regular life goes away, and you're back to I just would do anything for water, food, and shelter.
Right.
And that's a really cool place to be when you get there. So anyway, during that Wall Street experience, those six, well, actually from 95, I was on Wall Street for about 10 years. Six or seven of those years was running my own business. But during those 10 years doing that, those crazy races, I put on my first race in 2001. I put on a race down in the British Virgin Islands. This is a funny story. And it was a five-day race. It was 350 miles, and we had 25 of the best teams in the world come down to compete. They were teams of four, and it had sailing in it, kayaking, swimming, running, biking, climbing, self-supported. It was an insane race. It stormed for the entire five. I mean, crazy storms, 5 days. Well, unbeknownst to me, one of our guys that was setting the course with ropes in the crashing waves before the race started cut his leg. And he got into a dinghy, little dinghy. And the guys that finished setting the rope said, "Hey, why don't you go back to the island? And we're not going to need you for the rest of the race since you're injured. Go get sewn up. And we'll just catch you when the race is over 5 days from now." Well, fast forward, the race is over, after party. Now it's been like 6 or 7 days. No one's seen this guy.
Oh, no.
I find out about it at the end, at the party, and I'm like, how could it be that no? Well, we thought he was back at the island. We thought maybe he was just relaxing. We didn't know. We thought we'd run into him tonight at the party. So I had to get the Coast Guard involved. Coast Guard lays out their maps, and they look at Tobago and Little Tobago based on where somebody last saw him and the currents and the storms. And Little Tobago is uninhabited. It's 150 miles away from where we last saw this guy. And he drifted there. And he lived on this uninhabited island for the 5 or 6 days. He ate crabs and drank the water of the bottles of water that had fallen out of racers' backpacks and drifted to the same location. And I didn't know what he was going to do. And literally, when the Coast Guard landed the helicopter where we were, he said, "Hey, anybody want to go grab dinner?" he was absolutely cool. It was an awesome story. So between growing up in that crazy place in Queens and being around people that either got killed or went to jail, or running that construction and swimming pool business, which was like having a gun to your head 24/7, never enough hours in a day, or Wall Street and the stress of trading, or the races I was doing, it started to build some grit in my DNA, and there wasn't a day that went by when I didn't think about some of our most gritty people that have ever lived on this earth, right? And whether American Indians or the Spartans were just incredible people from that perspective. And so when this idea came about to create a race, and the name Spartan was thrown out there, it was natural. And so I found myself at that point in Vermont, trying to relax, not being
very good at it, clearly.
Not being very, I lasted about 3 days. And then we got this thing called Spartan Race, and I'm back in the fire. I mean, I'm not even in the frying pan, I'm in the fire, and doing 600 emails a day, doing phone calls. But unlike the last 30 years that I just described, I've never been in an experience. I could never be like a minister or a priest or a rabbi. I just don't have it in me. And it's such a good thing, right? Those people just put themselves at the back of the pack, right? In the back of the line, and they take care of other people. What, even a doctor. And I wish I could, but I'm not. But then you get these emails as a Spartan race owner that people say, "Hey, you changed my life. I was going to get divorced, or I lost a bunch of weight, or I was doing drugs," and it gives you, you get a little taste of what that must be like.
Right.
And it gives you, every day I'm pissed off, and I'm all these emails, and that wasn't the plan here. And then you get an email like that, and it's like, all right, you bought me another day.
Right.
I mean, it's like, you could do a lot of things on this earth, and to be lucky enough to make a living doing, you know, helping people is pretty powerful.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. I guess I feel a little parallel with that, where I used to coach people directly, and if I had an impact on their lives, like I saw it day by day. And as the things that I've done have been more successful, I've gotten more and more removed from actually being around people, and, you know, with books and doing the podcast and different things like that. And so there are certain days where I'm kind of like, I don't know if I'm doing anything other than spinning my wheels. And then we'll get some sort of a testimonial about, you know, somebody's kid had some, you know, autism, or their aunt had rheumatoid arthritis, and they end up modifying their diet and fixing their sleep, and the person's doing a ton better. And it's kind of like, okay, I guess it really does matter. But it's kind of funny, like, you can become really insulated from the actual, like, transformative process that is the whole point of doing this stuff. And it's kind of ironic. Like, if you do something like this and it's actually successful, you may end up being the last person in the world who knows that it's actually doing good work.
No, I think about what you just said every day. Yeah, I'm careful what you wish for, right? Because I really wanted to be doing this stuff. I was not planning on sitting at a computer all day every day, but
we're doing podcasts with someone like me. Yeah.
No, this is fun. I mean, I had heard of you, and so I have to say, and I hope it's not my ego that's saying it, it is pretty cool to be able to talk to a guy like, listen, 5-6 years ago, you wouldn't have taken my phone call. So to be able to be connected with someone like you, or, you know, the guy that actually killed Osama bin Laden called me 2 weeks ago. That's Tim Ferriss, right? That's those calls I would never get. So, right. So that's a nice look. Forget about anything monetarily. It's very powerful to be able to talk to cool people.
Right, right. So no, that is super cool. Hey, this is kind of a an out there question, but I have a really good friend, Joe Capuccio. He's a friend of ours in this food business that we have. Very, very successful. Played in the NFL. Created a food business. Basically, he's one of the largest seafood producers on the planet, and like he literally started with like a boat and then two boats, and it, old Italian family again, and so like really funny stories from that guy. But he said something that has stuck with me so long, and the fact that you're just I think 2 years older than I am. I have a 2-year-old daughter and then another one on the way, but Joe said something that was really interesting, which was, possibly the worst curse a boy can have is to have a wealthy father.
Yeah, I've heard that. And
what do you think about that? And like, what, you know, so clearly you've had a ton of success and like create the potentially big shoes and expectations. And I think a little bit about that with my own kids and how to navigate stuff. And, you know, it's interesting because it out in the, you know, the world at large, it seems like on the one hand, we have people who are so crazy. Like I saw this kind of Facebook picture that there was a sign that was on a Little League fence. And it was like, these are your kids. The umpires are unpaid. You never played in the major leagues. Let's have some fun. You know, kind of gig, like trying to defuse people who are totally over the top crazy at pushing their kids. So on the one hand, we have people that are maybe totally aggro and over the top on pushing their kids. And on the other side, it seems like a lot of parents are not giving their kids any sense of what you say, grit, you know, and that these kids can overcome and that they're going to fail multiple times. But really the point is getting back up and continuing and believing that they can do more than what they could do. But how are you kind of managing that amidst like multiple businesses and the notoriety of what it is that you're doing, and then trying to raise these kids in a way that they've got some really solid values and they can step outside dad's shadow and be their own entity?
I mean, there isn't a day or a minute that goes by that I don't think about it. And so it is at the forefront of my mind. And so when I go back and I think of my story a lot, like I'm sure you do, what made you the way you are, and a giant turning point in my life. I mean, it would have been a completely different outcome had my dad not lost everything when I was at that young age, because I was cocky, and it was definitely a curse to have a successful dad. I got anything I wanted. And so as tough as I am on them, like they have to watch TV in Mandarin, they do 2 hours a day of kung fu and wrestling. I make them do their chores, rain, shine, hurricane, snow, it doesn't matter. It's still a very bubble wrapped life. And so I think we have to move at some point in the next 2 or 3 years to a place that is a little more rugged, where they get, you know, whether it's some tiny little town in Mexico or someplace in China for at least a year, so they could experience having nothing. And I'll have, you know, my wife and I'll have to deal with that too.
Right.
But I think that's the only way. I mean, it was, when I moved to live with my mom, she had nothing. And so we no longer had TV. We couldn't pay for heat. She couldn't pay the mortgage on the house. And just that whole experience was, it was like going to college, you know, going to Harvard. It was incredible, that experience.
Right.
So,
you know, it's funny for me, I came from a very poor, when I say poor, it's relative, like really poverty in the United States is a very relative thing. But for the United States, it was a very modest upbringing, but to a degree that my parents really had kind of adopted this, this is the way it is. It's never going to be any different. And I never really cracked out of that until I was in Long Beach, California, and I met a Cambodian family that had fled out of Cambodia at the right near the end of the Khmer Rouge. They had to escape into Thailand. They were actually pretty wealthy in Cambodia, but because like they would go to bed one night and wake up and literally a whole family down the street would be gone. And they were kind of like, okay, when's our ticket going to come up? And so these people escaped out of Cambodia, were in a refugee camp in Thailand, made their way to the United States. Within the Cambodian community, it's a very tight-knit community, and they would give each other loans within the community. These people bought a donut shop and then a cleaner and then a Chinese food place, and they worked like I have never seen anyone work in my life. Like they had cots in the back of these shops that they owned. And what, you know, the mom or the dad would be on shift, the kids would be studying in between working. All the kids ended up going to school. I think there's like a mechanical engineer, a doctor, their son Sayla ended up being a just phenomenal martial artist. And so he's a top tier martial arts coach now and everything. But I mean, just an enormous amount of success. And when they arrived here, they didn't have a pot to piss in. They didn't speak the language. But yet within about 8 to 10 years, they own multiple businesses and were putting all their kids through school.
No, and I mean, this book, Spartan Up, is basically about that. I mean, that's the story. Like, you ever see Russell Crowe in the movie, was it Cinderella Man?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And when that interviewer interviews him and says, why are you fighting? Because he's a broken down fighter. His hand is busted. He has no business getting in a ring with a heavyweight. And he turns and he says, I'm fighting for milk, right? He's got no money. How do you compete with that? So they were fighting for milk, the people you just described. And we're spilling milk,
right?
Right. That's the difference. And so, yeah, be careful what you wish for. All these, you know, who was it? Malcolm Gladwell just wrote a book on David and Goliath.
Yeah,
it touches on a lot of that.
Totally amazing book. I've it's only been out of maybe 2 months, 3 months, and I've read that thing 3 times. It's phenomenal.
Yeah, I think it's the problem with our country, and it's not just this country. It's any country that's, and a lot of these countries are getting developed quickly. So the problem is, I used to call it Rocky. I recognized it at a very young age, right when my dad lost everything. I remember Rocky Balboa, right? He's hungry as can be, and he wins that first fight, and then he gets all this money, and then he gets lazy.
Right.
And many movies portray that. And I used to call it Rocky Syndrome. And it happens to the best of us. So how do you keep that work ethic? Because if you can work like the people you just described, it makes life so much better and so much more rewarding. But it's hard. It's hard for people to do. I call it a frame of reference change. If you can change your frame of reference, right? So what I like to do is every morning I do 300 burpees. And I did them this morning, and they suck. They never get better. They're always terrible. But in the old days, if you and I were living in a cave, or the people like the people you just described in the morning, they wake up, they don't even know what is going to happen to them
right
in the morning, right? You and I wouldn't know if a lion's going to attack us. And that's what our fight or flight mechanisms are designed to handle. And we don't get that anymore. And so when the simple little things in life come at us, like the coffee being too cold or the kid screaming or the car nuts, we get upset. We're screaming at the lady at the airport because she's charging us $10 for a bag. None of that should really happen. That's only happening because
we don't have the right frame of context.
Yeah, we don't have the right frame of reference. But you do 300 burpees in the morning. That's like meeting a friggin' grizzly every morning.
I would move to a different cave, man. If whatever cave you're in means 300 burpees every day, I would find a different cave. I would find a broom closet over that.
They suck.
But I get it. It totally makes sense. And you know, I did a reality show for the Discovery Channel, iCaveman, and they stuck us in this horrible environment. 2 weeks of starvation. I lost like 18 pounds on the deal, but it was really, really miserable the whole time. And when it was done, I was in a funk for probably a good 2 months.
Really?
Because the rest of my life was so dull and boring by comparison,
yeah,
that I just couldn't hardly stand it, you know? And so those really peak experiences, which is, I think, a lot of what the things that you've put together really touches on, like you have those really peak moments of experience that kind of time index your life. And you know, you have this mutual suffering with the people around you, and then also the kind of internal gut check of am I going to go on, or am I going to fold up and quit? And it was pretty interesting. Like every moment that the thing was going on, I wanted it to stop. And then when it really was done, I was like, damn, that was pretty special, you know?
No, it was just like the adventure races. I get it. Because I used to, every time I was in the middle of it, like when you were in the cave, I was thinking, I can't even believe I signed up for this.
Right.
This is friggin' terrible. And then every time it was over, I'm looking for the next one. It's, you know, I get it completely.
Joe, what's your, we had a girl on here, Laura Zera. She was on the Naked and Afraid show. She's a really gorgeous girl, phenomenal primitive skills expert, a really, really interesting background. And I asked her this question, which was, how do you cope with that mental suffering? Like with these shows, you could always say, okay, I'm going to quit. And, you know, with most of these races, you have an opportunity to quit. And, the people who don't, I'm always intrigued by what kind of the internal dialogue is that they have. Like, how do you tackle that? What's the internal dialogue that you have?
Everybody's got those little crickets, or however they describe them, little things that pop in their head and say, hey. And they come up, by the way, those crickets come up with really good logical reasons why you should quit and throw up the white flag. And it's hard. It's hard to convince yourself otherwise. I found recently, before I answer the question directly, I found recently that with the children, it's much harder because when the crickets use the kids as the logical reason to get off the bike at like 2 hours in when you planned a 4-hour ride, you can't win that argument. You're supposed to be with your kids. And then you go home and you end up sitting on the computer and you're like, all right, the crickets tricked me. That was just to get me home.
Right.
So, but for me, I think in the early days, it was about proving something to myself. And then somebody really, really smart I've become friends with, who was actually the early creator of video on the internet, gave me this idea. I don't know if you've ever heard it, of future memory.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard that term before?
Yeah, so
I'd never heard it before. And so I think the first few times that I pushed through and I was able to crush the crickets, it created obviously a release of chemicals in my brain at the finish line, like you had when you were done with your Discovery Channel show. And then when you go to attempt the next thing, your brain will actually release some of those chemicals in advance of the finish. So you can remember what the future is going to feel like and push yourself through, because listen, I've had some events that I didn't finish and it never goes away. That terrible feeling is just awful. And so I think it comes with some experience. Now, if you ask me the question regarding the people that never get through that first one, I just, that's probably has something to do with living a very coddled life, right? And so, like your friend in the food business described, if the child has had everything and never had to fail, well, it becomes hard for them to push through some of these things we're talking about, I think.
Because they never have that future memory. They never have that one imprint of success that they overcame something huge and then did something subsequent to that.
That's right.
Yeah. It's interesting, you know, for me, when I'm in stuff like that, when I've talked to different people, like folks who are in the special operations community, there's different coping strategies. And mine, interestingly, is that I give myself tons, like I'm constantly saying, oh, I'm going to quit. But I'll say, I'm not going to quit until noon. I can hang through this until noon, but at noon, I'll wrap it up. And then noon comes around and I'm like, ah, that wasn't so bad. I'll quit at 4 o'clock. And then 4 o'clock goes around. And so the way that I've coped with that stuff, I haven't heard a lot of people talk about that. Like usually they're just like, I'm not going to quit. Somebody would have to shoot me. And that's all there is to it. Whereas for me, if, if the time indexing is too long, this is something that made it hard for me to get done with school doing my undergrad. 4 years just seemed like an eternity. And so it finally took me a little while where somebody was like, you know what, man? And you know, I mean, this seems like it should just be completely obvious stuff. But the person was like, just tackle it a quarter at a time. And at the end of each quarter, if you don't want to keep going, then quit. But just finish that one quarter that you're in. I'm like, okay, that seems kind of reasonable. And then I started adopting that with different, you know, whether it was writing my book or this, Discovery Channel gig, and that's actually been really, really successful for me. Like, do you have internal dialogue like that, or are you just basically like,
I don't,
they're going to carry my dead body out of here before I
quit? No, it's funny because we put on one of our races, we put on a separate entity called the Death Race. We're pushing and challenging people to the limit in what you're currently describing. And so not only have I been a participant, but I'm also the guy actually providing the torture and watching people break and looking for correlations. And so I think the people that are, you know, you'll have to carry my dead body out of here, they tend to quit, believe it or not, more often than not. I use exactly what you say during it. Hey, you know what? I just got to make it to that telephone pole. I don't say to myself, I'm going to quit at the telephone pole, but I'm able to take bite-sized pieces and digest those one at a time. And again, but it comes from that experience of the finish line comes with or without you. I've learned. I remember I was probably three big races in, and it occurred to me, if I quit and go to a hotel room and we have to wait for the race to end before we can get out of here anyway, which could be 4 days from now, time is going to pass. And so that time can pass while I'm watching TV in a hotel room, which would feel really good, or the time could pass while I'm here and just get the job. I just get it done.
Right.
And so once I realized that, like, you can't stop time, like it's just going to keep moving with or without you. And then you're sitting there in the hotel, right? And the race is over and you're, well, shit, that wasn't, sorry, I cursed.
we curse like sailors on this thing. That's fine. All right, cool. I'm surprised we haven't been there yet. No.
Yeah. Like I could have did that. That wasn't so bad. And once you realize that, like, almost anything's possible. I mean, you look at Shackleton. I mean, look at what he had. I mean, anything's possible. It's just, look, those guys, I don't know if you followed that expedition that tried to recreate what Shackleton did with, you know, $9 million, I don't know what the amount of money was, of equipment, where Shackleton had, like, a piece of wood and a cloth.
Right.
They tried to redo that expedition, not when they left to go get help. And they had to get rescued,
right,
with all this fancy equipment. But I argue the reason that happened is because they could get rescued.
Right.
If Shackleton would have loved to get on the radio and say, hey, you know what, we're out of here. But he couldn't. There was no option. I used to, when I was first learning how to run long distance, I'd make my wife drop me 40 miles from the house. No money, nothing. Got to get home.
Burn the boats, basically. No, yeah, I mean, yeah. It totally makes sense. Like when you have a safety hatch, and that's part of Writing a book, like actually having a deadline, and part of your contract is that if you don't meet this deadline, you're going to get sued. And not only will you not make money, whatever money you have is probably going to be gone. And then all of a sudden, you don't do emails, you don't fart around on social media. You have a full-time job getting that thing that you contracted to get done, before the hatchet falls on you. So no, that's really powerful stuff.
Yeah, well, think about it. Almost every college kid will tell you, right? When does the report or any project that's due get done? It gets done right at the deadline.
What do they call that? A Parkinson's law or something? Like any project will expand to the duration that you give it. And so if it's 2 days to make a decision, it'll take 2 days. If it's 2 years, it'll take 2 years. So
And that's interesting because in business, what I do is I like to put false deadlines in place, and it works. And the other there's another thing. I don't know if you have a law for this, but if I have to do my 300 burpees, if I tell myself we're doing 1,000 today, 300 becomes easy.
Easy, right?
And then when we get to 300, I say, I'm done at 300. That's really all I intended to do anyway.
I had an
But
easy day,
an
right?
easy day. So,
That's
yeah.
awesome stuff. Joe, what else do you have cooking here? So you did some work with the folks who were impacted by the Boston Marathon bombing. Like, what other things do you have that's kind of dovetailing into this? It's interesting, the things like CrossFit, things like the Spartan Race, they have both an online presence, but then clearly these in-person, experiences, it starts creating these really interesting, very vibrant social networks. Like, what are you doing that's kind of springboarding off of that stuff?
I mean, the biggest thing for me is interviews with people like you. I've never done any of this stuff before, and we got approached, had to be a year and a half ago, and somebody came up and said, "You want to do a book?" I said, "Well, I have a book in my head I've been working on for like 30 years, but I don't know if I want to do a book."
Clearly, no deadline on that one.
No deadline on that one. I just didn't want to die first, and he explained that actually everybody wants to is willing to talk more easily, willing to talk to you, and you can do interviews and things. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And it's been true. And the amazing thing for me, I'm sure it's different for you, is the book business doesn't seem like a very good business. Like it just it doesn't really make that much money unless you self-publish, I guess. And you don't have to sell that many books to like I think they sell more pieces, more bulldozers than they do books,
Right,
right?
right.
But yeah, everybody wants to talk, is more willing to talk about a book.
Right.
So just doing all these fun podcasts and interviews is big, which then leads to more charity discussions. So that's really, where CAF came from. And we're working with another charity called Support the Troops. And what these guys do is, and they've been doing it 30 or 40 years, where they package up like cigars and chia seeds and whatever they can get, Whole Foods or anybody to donate, Girl Scout cookies, and they package them up and they ship them over to guys and girls that are on the front line and that need stuff. And they'll even put toys in the boxes. I went down to the factory where they wrap everything up and ship them out. And I said, "Why do you put toys in there?" And he said, "Well, if you're in Iraq or Afghanistan or anywhere, and if our military can give toys to the kids will look out for them and say, hey, don't go around that corner there."
Right.
And so I thought that was really interesting. So anyway, we're helping these guys, which is exciting because I feel like kind of a wimp that I wasn't in the military. It's something that bothers me, and so I've got massive military envy, and I love being around all these guys and girls that are high ranking, and just makes you feel cool to be connected with them.
Right.
So that's a big one going on. And then this other thing I'd love to get you involved in, we're doing, is called the 431 Project. And the idea there was back in 431 BC, we came up with the four elements, right? Earth, and I always screw this up, air, water, fire. And today's four elements for the next generation, or even us, right, is cell phone, coffee, couch,
Right.
computer. And they're saying that the next generation, and I'm sure you've researched this more than me, could live 5 years less than us because of that change in lifestyle.
Right.
And so I said, what if we create this awesome event in Vermont? We have a farm up in Vermont that's like Davos meets TED Talks meets Spartan Race farm to table dinner. And we bring like a couple hundred people, and the only requirement is they have to have fire in their belly. They actually get stuff done in life. And it could be anything. It could be an astronaut, could be an artist, could be a nutritionist. And so we're going to try to bring everybody together. I think it's September 21 up in Vermont and do this cool weekend. And the goal is going to be to start to create media around trying to get to these 16 to 21-year-olds that are going to be the next parents, next set of parents, to give them a leg up like I had because of my mom that introduced the healthy way of life. If I didn't have that, if my mom had not, I'd still be eating that Chinese food with the guy. Right. Seriously, I wouldn't have known.
Right.
And so if we can get to the 16 to 21-year-olds and just give them a taste, whether it's with video or something, that man, you could feel so much better, do so much better, whatever. Like, people forget the brain lives inside of the body. If the body's unhealthy, the brain's going to be unhealthy. And so anyway, that's a cool project we're working on. I'd love to have you involved in that if you had any interest.
I would love that. And, you know, we're good friends with Joel Salatin of Polyface Farms. And
would love him there.
He's not far from that. So yeah. Let's put something together with that. So, Joe, what else did we miss? I feel like we covered at least a little spackling of your background and what you've been up to and what you're doing next. What else do you want to wrap up with?
Well, we want everybody to come out and do the Spartan Race. And if anybody, if any one of your listeners or whatever is nervous, they don't have to be nervous. We've got 74-year-olds, 4-year-olds, you name it. They all get it done. And if anybody's hurting for money and wants the book or wants to come out and do a race, they could shoot me an email, joe@spartan.com, and I'll hook them up. I always do. For us, it's less about the money and more about just getting people out there and living life.
Awesome. So
that's the message.
Right on, Joe. Well, it's been great talking to you. We will have links to the forthcoming book, Spartan Up, which is available currently on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all those sorts of things. Are you going to do a book tour? Like, do you know if you're going to be in specific cities supporting
the book? I'm doing, I think right around the launch, we're doing something really cool in New York City at a CrossFit gym on Madison Avenue.
Okay.
Which everybody is welcome to. But I don't know exactly when it is. So
when you get details, we'll get it out to people. We'll push it out via the social media that we have. We'll make sure folks know about it.
Appreciate that.
Awesome, Joe. Well,
thanks for having me.
Oh, man, it was great connecting with you. Super excited to talk to you and excited to meet you in person. I doubt I will be able to make the September gig. Our second second kid is arriving late August or late July, early August, and I have a feeling that my wife is going to trim my travel wings. When we had the first kid, I had stuff scheduled a month after Zoe arrived, and that was not a popular. My wife's Italian, so
she's not letting you go anywhere.
Yeah, this time I'm going to give it a good 4 to 5 months before I get back out on the road. So yeah,
congratulations on the baby.
Thank you, man. I'm very, very excited.
Kung Fu.
You know what, Zoe actually goes to jiu-jitsu and watches. My jiu-jitsu coach is actually a woman. She got second place at the Pan Ams in the 130-pound black belt division. And so Zoe watches her grapple with these other guys. And Zoe's only 2 years old, but she's just fascinated by this stuff. And the other day, you know, she has stuffed animals and all this, and she'll get in and do side control and take them out and do an arm bar on these animals just from watching. And the cool thing with kids, they don't really require any instruction. You just make it fun and make it kind of play-based, and they're all over it. So yeah, she's getting her ground combatives figured out already. So
there won't be a teddy bear or a doll in your house that can mouth off.
With a good elbow. Yeah. Yeah. All the elbows are going to be broken. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thanks, Rob.
Great having you on, Joe. We'll talk to you soon.
You got it. Bye-bye. Okay,
take care.